I think she's just having so much problems with the finality of it. You know, that he's there one day and he's gone the next and he's never coming back. And that, you know, they were married 61 years. They knew each other 63 years. And I think she's trying to learn who she is without him. You know, she's just grieving terribly. She's crying. She's, I mean, in one way, she's, so many people are reaching out, and I'm learning it so much about grief during this process. I'm learning the intimate parts of grief that I never knew. Like I'm learning how to help someone grieve, you know, even though I just made this film, like the people that call, it is special. Like I never knew how much a phone call helps, or someone reaching out in a special way helps. And she's just telling me every day, so many people from her past are reaching out and helping her. But I think it's the sorrow of, like, I don't know how this will ever, how she'll ever heal. I don't know. I don't know what to tell her. I don't know how to help her except to just be there for her and love her and listen to her. And she lives in Florida and I live in New York, and I was there for a while and I had to come back, you know, to my life. I can't, so I'm going to go back there, but it's very hard.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleason and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift.
Welcome to the Shapes of Grief podcast. Today I'm joined by filmmaker Jill Campbell in the Hudson Valley, New York. Jill, you're very welcome.
Hi, nice to be here and nice to meet you.
Yeah. So those of you who follow Shapes of Grief on Twitter or Instagram or LinkedIn will know that I shared a documentary a couple of weeks ago called Seat 20D, and Jill is responsible for the creation of that amazing documentary. And we're going to talk today about the making of the documentary, why you decided to make it, Jill, and maybe a little bit about what you learned about grief in the process. So let's go back to the whys. Did you have any direct connection, Jill, with anybody on Pan Am Flight 103 that shot down over Lockerbie nearly 30 years ago?
I didn't have any direct connection, but I went to Ithaca College, and I was about the same age as Alexei, who, you know, was Sousa's son and who passed away on Pan Am Flight 103. And I studied in London the year before that he was studying in London, because, you know, anyone watch the film, 35 Syracuse University students who were studying abroad in London were on the plane and unfortunately, you know, passed away on when the flight was bombed over Lockerbie, Scotland. So because, and Ithaca College and Syracuse University shared a lot of classes when I was studying in London. Like, so I knew a lot of Syracuse University students, and Ithaca is very close to Syracuse. So I was like very, very obsessed with this flight. I mean, it was horrible. And the fact that, you know, 35 students were killed and they were like my age. And it kind of had this imprint, like for years, every time I got on a flight, I would think about that flight. Like it was just daunting. So
the guys that you weren't on that plane, you could have been there, but for random chance goes my life.
100%, like exactly. And yeah. And so then when we, I was in Montauk, New York. I was actually with my husband and we were just, you know, looking for things to do. It was a rainy day and he saw this little blurb in this newspaper that was I wouldn't say advertising because SUSE never advertise or tries to, you know, market. It's such a weird thing because you're talking about a child's death, but it told about dark elegy. So we were like, let's just go check this out. You know, and we got there and I was so blown away, you know, for, you know, my connection to this tragedy and how much I followed it and also just SUSE's work and just overwhelmed us. And just everything, like being there. And
so let's rewind for listeners who haven't seen C20D and let them know who SUSE is and what dark elegy is.
So SUSE Lowenstein is a sculptor and an artist, an amazing woman who lost her son, Alex Lowenstein. She calls him Alexei. On the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. And he was a Syracuse University student. And, you know, he was one of the, unfortunately, one of the children that was shot down in the flight. So the sculpture garden, you know, when SUSE, the sculpture garden was created because SUSE, upon hearing the news of her son's death, fell into this a ball and of course was devastated. I mean, I'm a mother. As a mother, that's your worst nightmare. And I think as soon as you become a mother, that's always your worst nightmare, is losing a child. So you know, as an artist, she turned to her art. She, you know, what she says is like it kept her from like drinking herself to death. It helped kept her sane. And she started, you know, after the funeral, after everything, trying to figure out what to do, she started sculpting herself in the position she fell when she, upon hearing the news of her son's death. And she found solace in this. And then, so she sculpted her, and she sculpted herself life size and naked. And she says she sculpted herself nude because she was stripped of everything she had. And that's how she felt. And during this time, the other parents and relatives that had lost loved ones in the bombing had formed a group to figure out how this happened politically and also to offer solace and comfort each other. And they had a newsletter, and SUSE thought, well, this is helping me. Maybe it will help some of the other parents or relatives who lost, not just parents, not just women, relatives who lost loved ones. So she just put a little, they had, you know, a little newsletter. I don't even know if they had email back then. No, they didn't. It was 1988. She put the blurb in the newsletter and she got this overwhelming response. And it was, and she's, you know, she said it was, she invited men, but it was just the women that responded. It wasn't all mothers. It was different types of relatives, and all these women wanted to be involved. So basically what she did is she had them come to her studio, or she would go to them and she would take pictures of them, very private, nude, which is amazing that they allowed this, and then and have them fall into the position they fell upon hearing the news. And she would create a sculpture of that woman. So this process, and she says it took her 15 years, but she took her time. She spaced it out because it gave her so much solace. She knew if she wasn't working on this, she might fall apart. So she spent 15 years and she created what she calls Dark Elegy. And it's a sculpture garden of over, I think it's 78 sculptures of life-size women in the positions they fell upon hearing the news of their loved one's death. And the garden, when I discovered it, was she has it in the backyard of her, she lives in Montauk, New York. It's a beautiful beach town. And her son Alex was a surfer. So basically it resides in the backyard of her home, and she opens it to the public from 10 to noon daily. And I mean, I could go on about with the movie, and the reason why it's in the back, her backyard, is because after she created the sculpture, she wanted to donate this to a public park or a museum or a sculpture garden or anywhere. And she was willing to
university as well, right? That was her primary focal point.
Absolutely.
She had lost 35 students.
Yep, Syracuse University. She wanted, you know, she wanted this, and she was willing to have the sculpture's bronze, which is very expensive, and nobody would take it. And the reason, you know, there's so many different reasons, and you know, I personally, I think it's because it's this, the women are naked, and Americans are still prudish. And although I don't understand that, because there's so many amazing works of naked art all over Europe and all over the United States, but I think it's also like this raw grief, different type of memorial. So
it's very confronting. It's very confronting to look at, and it really symbolizes the death denying society we live in, the grief denying society we live in. And I think particularly in America, where it's all about being happy and being positive and being optimistic and creating this Truman Show kind of vibe everywhere, this raw, naked grief is just too incongruent with the message that America tries to present a lot of the time.
I think that's so spot on. And I think the fact that, like I told you, I lived in London, and I lived in London after I studied, I went and lived for 3 years. And it's kind of where I started, like I was a playwright and now I'm a filmmaker, and it's really formed the basis of my art and my own artistic career, which I feel like in Europe is much more raw and open and accepting of these norms. And I agree with you. It is a Truman Show. And, you know, people that go there and accept this work are blown away, and you experience, because she's allowing you to experience the grief with her. Like, we grieve, you know, every time one of these terrorist attacks happen, or a gunman goes into a disco or a school and kills someone, we're all grieving. The world is grieving, and we want to grieve. I want to grieve with those relatives and those loved ones. And I feel like Dark Elegy allows you, when you go there, she's sharing her grief with you, which is so generous, you know? And yeah.
So back to you then, Jill, and your link. You didn't say fascination. I don't remember what word you used, but you were drawn into this terror attack and the fact that it could have been you. They were, you know, but for the roll of a dice, it was you sitting on that plane going home, and you being one of those 35. I think we must be the same age as well, late 40s.
And
there was something about the parallels there that drew you to this. What made you decide to make a documentary about it, Jill?
Hi everyone, excuse this brief interruption. It's Liz here, and I wanted to tell you about my grief training program. If you are interested in becoming grief literate or grief trained, I've designed a comprehensive online program which you can do at your own pace in your own time. It's been designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we all have a right to grief training and education. So if you're interested, then it's for you too. Sign up today at shapesofgrief.com. Now, back to the podcast.
A great question. And it's a question for every documentary. Like, why am I going to make this documentary? Because you're devoting to each documentary 3 or 4 years of your life, creating it. You know, my husband works with me. He's my partner. He helps me produce, and he's just my right-hand man. And so we went back to our hotel after seeing Dark Elegy, and we couldn't stop thinking about it. You know, you know, I was trying to figure out what my next project would be. I just finished working on this film called Mr. Chibs, about an ex-NBA basketball player. But my films are very raw and not It would be a compliment to say they're more European. Like, I didn't make a typical basketball doc about Kenny Anderson. I made a documentary about an NBA star in a midlife crisis, trying to figure out what he was going to do with the rest of his life and dealing with alcohol issues. So I was trying to figure out what my next project would be. And I was just decided, you know what, I'm going to just get in touch with Sousa and see if she'd be interested in us coming to film her and making the documentary about the project. And at first I thought it was just going to be a short documentary, like 15, 20 minutes. And of course I'm calling her cold, which is, you know, really hard, and she's lost a child. So that made it even more difficult. I mean, this is basically the hardest film I've ever worked on, because I'm dealing with people that have experienced what I think is the worst grief imaginable. And so I got in touch with her, and she was first, you know, talked to her. She was like, who are you? I sent her my work. I sent her Mr. Chibs. I sent her some articles about me. I told her what I wanted to do. And she was a little reticent because, you know, she had spent, you know, I think it's 32 years, but when I met her, it was like 29 years, you know, dealing with this and dealing with the press and talking about it. And it's still raw. It's still right here. It's still on the surface. So we just decided, she was in Florida, and we decided, like, when she got home, we would just come and meet her. We brought our cameras and, you know, the way I work is just kind of take it really slow, not push, because I really kind of got that vibe from her. Like, maybe I would get one day at Dark Allergy, you know, and that would be it. Maybe I'd get 10 minutes. So we just kind of got there and had our cameras, and we just, you know, and she was awesome from the moment we got there. And I think it's also because we weren't pushing, and because I was just following her lead. And I think once she started talking about it, and because I was also focusing on her work as an artist and Sousa as a person, and I specifically was not focusing on the political aspect of this, because there've been a lot of different documentaries and work on the political aspects of this. I wanted to focus on what happens after, what happens, you know, when your world is blown apart, and how
the human story
that she was portraying in her work. And it's kind of interesting, because I feel like my films are kind of like her work, and, you know, and the film took on like her personality. So we went and we filmed, and they were hard to film because they're huge, they're life size, and they're bigger. And so we experimented, we played, we interviewed her. You know, it was crazy. We got there. We had a dog at the time that was dying, and I didn't want to leave the dog alone. So I brought my dog with me, and we had the dog in the car, and she was okay with that. And, you know, we're pretty chill, but, you know, you're filming with a lot of equipment and sound, but at the same time, I like to use very small crews, and especially for something like this, because I want to get that intimacy. So it was just Greg and I at first, who just went, and then she, you know, after we did the day, of course, I just wanted to film forever and ever, you know, and she's very busy. So she agreed to let us do another day. And then she agreed to let us do another day. And then we started to become friends, I think. And I think she started to trust me. And I would make, you know, I was making little demos and editing little pieces along the way. I really did think it was going to be a short. So I made a couple of shorts and I would send them to her. And I could tell she liked what I was doing. And then we, you know, there's this amazing cellist named Jean Fox. And Jean Fox also vacations in Montauk and discovered Dark Allergy, and suggested to Sousa that it might be really interesting to do a concert in the garden on 9/11. And Sousa agreed. So Sousa mentioned that to us and allowed us to film that. And that was beautiful. And all the, you know, a lot of big audience people, locals came, tourists, people who had lost loved ones in 9/11 were there, firemen, and Gene Fox. Like everything about this project, it was just so beautiful and so generous. Like we were we didn't have a lot of funds for it, but people just gave me their time for free. Like, so Gene, who knows a lot about documentary, just offered me all her music for free. And she rescored things for me. And she, you know, she was just a blessing. And
it was a beautiful piece of documentary, actually, just her playing the cello in the middle of all of these life-size grieving women. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And I specifically was so, I'm so happy. I just played the whole piece. I didn't want to be like a movie where you cut it. I'm like, this is gorgeous. And I'm just going to, you know, for once, just show that whole piece. And yeah, I mean, part of me is like, maybe I should do some outtakes now, like trying to get the film out there. That might be a great, beautiful, like, we've so much footage and so much amazing, because we went back, we shot 2 years in a row with Jean. And the first year was when she was crying afterwards. And there was that amazing scene where she goes up to Sousa and she's just hugs her and is so, it's just an amazing moment. And then the second year, she wasn't wearing the same clothes. And I didn't even think about it. Like, and she was wearing a different dress. And so we couldn't cut those two performances in to each other. So I have all this footage that I couldn't use, which I would love to share because it's just so beautiful.
Yeah. And what's striking me here is just this image of this massive sculpture. If you can imagine 78, like you say, life-size women in all of these poses. And it's holding the grief, like the grief is in there. But there's something really poignant, and it says a lot about our society that nobody wants it. Nobody wants to hold the grief. Nobody wants to bear witness to that grief. You know, we're all great at saying, oh, let me know if I can do anything, or, you know, trying to fix it, or we want people to be over it, but we don't want that constant reminder that there, but for the roll of a dice, it could be me either dead, or it could be me grieving my child or my beloved. It's too confronting for so many people. And I love this notion of you coming along, Jill, and saying, I'll hold your grief. I'll hold it in my movie. I'll give it a home. I'll give it space, you know, where we can hold it and we can share it digitally, you know, and it can be held in that way. There's something lovely about that happening for Sousa. Did that ever get talked about between you, that notion?
That is so beautiful. I feel like, no, it never got talked about, but you know, when she said early on, I hugged it, I decided to just hug the tragedy and hug the grief, that really, really stuck with me. And I think, yeah, I think in a way it was never talked about, but it was like, I felt like this film was an extension of her work. It's all her, you know, it's her work, but we're both artists and we're female artists and I'm a mother and my son, you know, is 25, but was like 22 when I was filming this. And so the same age that Alex was when he, you know, or about the same age. So I think as a mother, we did talk about that, she knew that I, as much as I could understand, you can never.
Well, you understand what it is to love a child. Yeah.
I mean, it's, and also like, you know, I've never, it's weird because luckily I'd never had a lot of, you know, I've had grandparents that passed or some friends, but not that close. But my father just passed away like a month ago. And my mother's grieving. I'm grieving, of course. And my mother's grieving terribly. And I learned so much through making this film. It's helping me through my grief. I told my mother about Sousa hugging. My mother is, you know, she was married 61 years to my dad. And I was with, you know, we were in hospice with my dad. We walked through death with him. And my mother wailed when she heard the news. I've never experienced that. And so, yeah, I think it's all part of that. But I think I don't want to lessen, like what you said is just so beautiful to me, because I feel like that's the goal in making this film. It's like, it's not self-serving. It's not like, it's just artist and sharing her world, you know, but yeah, I'm an artist too. So it's like, we're working together. We're collaborating.
There's something about the length of time, Jill, that it took to make this documentary that I would imagine could have been healing as well for Sousa. You know, watching the documentary and seeing these people come into her garden and be moved and turn to her and say, it's amazing and thank you so much. And then they're gone and then someone else comes, oh, it's amazing. And that must be exhausting, like that nobody stays or nobody's around for the permanence of your grief, the longevity of your grief, the 30 years of your grief. You know, the people come and they're moved and they say whatever they say, their platitudes or their silence, and then they go. And I can imagine it would be hard to really let your guard down with each of those people. You know, you have to protect yourself because they're coming, like I said, but here you come and then you come back and then you're still there and you're still there. And I can almost, you know, I don't want to assume her, Sousa's experience, but you can almost understand how she could rest in the knowledge that you were going to come back again and again and hold this with her. But back to your own recent bereavement here, Jill, I'm so sorry, just a month ago, that must have been when we first made contact with each other, that your dad died. And I'm struck by your words, my mother is grieving terribly. What does grieving terribly look like?
God, it's I think she's just having so much problems with the finality of it. You know, that he's there one day and he's gone the next and he's never coming back. And that, you know, they were married 61 years. They knew each other 63 years. Mm-hmm. And I think she's trying to learn who she is without him, you know. She's just grieving terribly. She's crying. In one way, so many people are reaching out, and I'm learning it so much about grief during this process. I'm learning the intimate parts of grief that I never knew. Like I'm learning how to help someone grieve. You know, even though I just made this film, like the people that call, it is special. Like, I never knew how much a phone call helps or someone reaching out in a special way helps. And she's just telling me every day, so many people from her past are reaching out and helping her. But I think it's the sorrow of, like, I don't know how she'll ever heal. I don't know. I don't know what to tell her. I don't know how to help her except to just be there for her and love her and listen to her. And she lives in Florida and I live in New York, and I was there for a while and I had to come back, you know, to my life. I can't, so I'm going to go back there, but it's very hard.
Yeah. It's very hard just to let grief be, isn't it? It's you know, like you're there questioning, going, what can I do? What can I say? How do I help? And exactly as you've also said, all we can really do is bear it alongside somebody, you know, bear their grief with them.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, we're all going to experience it. It's the one feeling, you know, everyone in life is going to unfortunately experience. And I do think hospice was beautiful for me. Like, we died with my father. We went through it. We had to make the decision to put him into hospice. It was only 4 days. my mother told me to film some of it. I took out my camera and filmed it, which was wild. And there might be a short doc in that. I mean, she was okay with it. And it's still very raw and fresh. I mean, I feel like, you know, I was a wreck for a while. I'm feeling a lot better now, but I'm more, when I see my mother, I just lose it. Or if my mother starts crying, I just lose it. But it's nice to hear you say that, like living with it. Like I'm learning. And I mean, with your podcast, are you a grief counselor? I've read a lot about on your website, but like, what are your goals to help people just going through grief?
I work as a grief therapist.
Oh, okay.
I have clients who come on Zoom nowadays, mostly. I've worked with hundreds of people over the last few years. And the podcast came from, I suppose, my frustration with the world, that so few people really understood grief until they were walking the walk. And it felt like an act of kindness and an act of service to offer this platform for various reasons, for people to tell their stories, which in of itself is a really therapeutic thing to do. And then for other people to hear those stories and go, I'm not alone. And, you know, while everybody's story is different and while grief is unique to all of us, we're also really the same, you know. And I read a ton of books and many people send me their books about their experience of loss. And they're all unique and everybody's name is different. Yet our basic humanity really is so similar. So to share it, every time we share it, someone else will find that and feel, you know, as I said to someone I just interviewed before you, Jill, another Jill, actually, you know, a mother in Kerala, India, wrote to me a couple of weeks ago to say that her little girl had died in December of last year, and that it was listening to the podcast that got her through the year. And that means the world to me. You know, it's, I think something that's always been really, really important to me is to have a purposeful life, to live a meaningful life, and that my life has some purpose, you know, that it's not just here consuming, sucking in air, sucking in oxygen, sucking out carbon dioxide. It feels important to me to do something good with the dash between 1972 and whatever year I'll die in. And this certainly feels like a lovely way of doing that. When you get these little reminders or tags on Instagram or Facebook that says, thank you, this made a difference, it's helped me through a hard time. And I think, like most people who do something like this, I've had hard times in my life and haven't had that person or that place or that podcast or that book that I really could have used at certain times of my life. So maybe in the providing it for others, it's a little bit of healing that part of yourself that wasn't met in those dark times that many of us experience, you know?
That's super gorgeous. And it's really helpful to hear because it's, yeah, I think that's, yeah, it's kind of why I make films and why I made this film. You know, I mean, it's intangible. It's hard to explain. Like, art is in all of what we do. What you do is an art too. It's very intangible, but it helps. And I think when you're asking my mother, like what you said, it brought up, like my mother with her grief is, you know, just, yeah, that he's not coming back. She just can't get over the finality of it. So I think you're right. We are all the same and we need to hear it. And Sousa hugging her grief and accepting it is helping us all. You know, we just need to learn. We need help during this time.
I think essentially grief is such a lonely process, and it's so, I say these words over and again on the podcast. I'm sure listeners are sick of listening to me. It's so visceral. It's so lonely. It's so scary. It's so rage-inducing. And for many people, you know, if you look at a Hollywood movie, which is, you know, the barometer of how many of us live our lives, you know, we think someone dies, we cry, and then there's someone who comes and redeems them and all is fine with the world again. And we know that grief isn't like that. We don't heal from grief. We don't move on from it. we learn to live with it. We learn to firstly accept the reality of the loss, to turn to face the grief, or we will suffer forever trying to avoid it. And then to learn to create parts of ourselves that maybe we didn't have before that are able to carry the grief. But all of that is a process, you know, and it takes time.
I think that, and I going back to Dark Elegy, I think that that completely describes what it is. You know, like you're there and you know, people are visiting it at different stages of their life or different relationships with grief, but you're there and you have all of those feelings. And then you have this feeling for Sousa and the other mothers. And it also brings me to, you know, I interviewed two other mothers that lost their child on that flight. And again, it was their generosity blew me away. And they were the hardest interviews I ever did in my life.
So beautiful, those women. Oh my God.
Oh my God. Yeah. There was that one moment where Aphrodite literally, like, you know, we're talking to her and she's talking about her daughter who she lost. And then you see her face where she just relives that moment for a second, like on camera, or when she talks about she got uterine cramps when she heard that her child had died and
her womb started aching. Yeah, that really stuck with me.
Like, yeah, and I can imagine it as a mother, you know, but she was so honest with us. And that's why this film is there. You know, I'm hoping, I really hope that it does help anyone, just like what you're doing. I hope just by watching it, like, it's not the Hollywood story. It's raw. It doesn't have a happy ending. It has a hopeful ending because Sousa is so hopeful.
And her husband dies towards the end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was also super difficult and so generous of Sousa to let me in during that time because he was sick the whole time. So he, you know, we got him on camera that once during the concert, but I never wanted to ask, you know, I never pushed that relationship. I was always very respectful of that. And then it was only later in the edit that I realized this is part of the story, you know, because she's creates her sculpture garden about grief and her husband's dying during this time too. And so I had to try to build him as a character, without having much footage of him. And I tried to do that very subtly too. And it was great because she shared, you know, those amazing archival the footage of her, you know, on the beach with him and in the 70s and when the kids were young in the 80s. And and that was really rough. And she went through a second set of grief with him. So.
It really, watching that scene where she's sitting out, it's a porch or a balcony or a decking or something.
Yeah, it's her front porch.
And like, I just had this yearning to just go and sit with her on that porch, you know, and it made me really reflect on the loneliness of our society and what we've created in Western society, where we have these mothers grieving their children who are dead or gone or have never been born. We have these children grieving their mothers that weren't available to them. We have all these people with this existential loneliness, and the way we've set up our lives to be in these individual, beautiful houses surrounded by land where we can't get at each other anymore, you know? And it struck me a few years ago, I went over to Calais in the north of France, mm-hmm. where there was a refugee camp mm-hmm. set up. And it was the time in Europe 4 or 5 years ago where it was on the news all the time, just dozens of refugees were dying, drowning in the sea every day. And there was one poignant photo of a little boy, he was 3 years old, washed up on the beach, his body. And I remember thinking it's not okay just to watch this and cock my head and go, oh, isn't it awful? I have a responsibility to do something. These are my fellow humans, you know? And an opportunity came where two young British lads set up a big dome in the middle of the jungle, the refugee camp, And we're offering workshops to anybody who wanted to come. And I volunteered my time. I said, I'll come. Awesome. You know, I only have 7 days, but I can come. I'll do whatever you want. I can serve food, or I can host a dance space, or do some drama therapy, or whatever, you know, whatever skills I have that can be of service here. And I went there and, you know, had this experience and offered my services and came back. And I remember meeting a neighbor in my local vegetable shop, and I'd been on the news, apparently. I don't even remember being filmed, but I was filmed. And she said, oh, I saw you on the news. And she said, what was it like? It must have been awful. And yes, of course, it was a horrible human tragedy. Yet there was also what I picked up when I was there, the humanity that was there of these people living together, minding each other, taking care of each other, respecting the church, the mosque, and, you know, having this respect, coexisting, being in community everywhere together, dancing together, which was lovely. That was, you know, part of me had been questioning my work and going, oh God, did I even offer anything? Was it any good? And only afterwards someone said to me, that's the first time the different nationalities actually participated in something together. Normally they only, stuck to their own nationality. Yeah. So I was really happy to hear that. But my point in the vegetable shop, and this woman said, was it awful? And I said, you know something, I actually feel really lonely since I came home, back to my own little house, and I miss the hustle and bustle and always someone being there. And a lot of underdeveloped communities that we call underdeveloped, they have that. They have that community and love and support for each other that we've lost in Western culture. And for me, that's a very long outtake to what watching Souza alone grieving on her chair.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's what watching her grief, but then allowing us into that grief is like her way, her community, and then setting, you know, allowing people in every day to her backyard from 10 to 12. Like, I did actually, I have a couple of things to say, because that sounds super interesting what you experienced, and I agree. Like, I mean, one thing to say is, like, I did ask her once, did she mind every day having these strangers in her backyard? And she said, no, I love it. She loves it. She loves to look out and people are looking at her work. And it's only from 10 a.m. to noon. So she has her boundaries where, you know, there's not always someone in her backyard. But I thought that was a gorgeous answer. And I think another thing that you've brought up is like right now with COVID, it's horrible. Like all this grieving alone, like, you know, I went through it with my father, and I'm Jewish, and in the Jewish community, you know, we sit Shiva for a week, and we that is our community of having people around. And you're Irish, and I'm the Irish funerals or
wakes,
you know,
yeah.
Wakes, Irish wakes, or, you know, I wonder what that says is like, it makes it more lonely. I mean, yes, we have Zoom. Yes, people are calling, but you just don't have the people around. Like, people kept sending us food. And it was just my mother and I, and my brother's a vegan. So we were like, my mother and I were like, we can't eat all this food. What do we, you know, it was beautiful. It was beautiful that people were doing that. But
you missed out on people bearing witness to your grief and bearing witness to your experience and carrying it with you, accompanying you in the shock of it. And I think, you know, there's a man, a BBC reporter, Kevin Tullis, who speaks about, you know, the Irish wake, and we have people who come up and say, I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry for your loss. And you might hear that 200 times over 2 or 3 days. And he describes it beautifully, like what is happening is every time someone takes your hand and says, he's dead. He's dead. He's dead. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not what they're saying, but it is what they're saying.
Yeah.
It helps us accept the reality of the loss, which is, according to Warden, one of the first tasks of grief. We need to accept that this is real.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. It's like, that's, I don't think my mother's there yet. Like, that when you asked me about my mother, like, she's just not there yet, but it's only a month. So she really needs time. But I agree, like now where you said you had this beautiful community and you're experiencing all this grief in Calais, now we have COVID and now we're even more alone. And like funerals are Zoomed, you know? And I remember I flipped out at the funeral because we went to my parents had a place arrangement, they have a crypt. They're not buried in the ground. They chose this crypt and they live in Boca Raton, Florida. It's beautiful. It looks like a Hilton hotel. It's very bizarre, very Florida. But, you know, we went there the day before and I was like, all right, you know, we're going to Zoom the funeral. We have 50
people. Glamorizing death again.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, we're Zooming it. We're, you know, and I'm producer director and I'm like in charge of it all. And I had to get cords to, you know, and we get there and the crypt could not pick up any internet signal. And, you know, we had five people that could show up to the funeral, you know, and so many elderly, we didn't want anyone to really show up. I mean, people did, which was beautiful. And that really upset me because we ended up getting it to work because we had to turn the whole chapel around. We had to open every door in the chapel. We had to put our computer almost in the parking lot and Zoom from there. But we had 50, we had all our family and friends and grandchildren and we needed that. I needed that. And we did get it to work. It was wonky and in and out, but I agree. It's like, you need that community. You need someone you need your people so much during this time.
When someone you love dies, you're so dysregulated and you need familiar faces and people who care to help you regulate again as much as possible. That's so important to have that presence there.
I agree.
Even virtual.
Yeah. If they weren't there, I would love the five people that were there, but we were all like, and it's weird because we're all like, we must film the funeral. We must get the Zoom to work, which is like a weird thing because it's a funeral. But it's like, it's about what you said. Like you just need the community.
And Joe, tell me if you're willing, what is sitting Shiva like? It's 7 days. What are all the things that would have happened if we weren't living through a pandemic for you, your mom and your brother?
It's... So, I mean, we're not very religious, but the really religious sit on boxes and they're like, they don't sit on furniture. They put black cloth on mirrors. But basically for, you know, we're pretty secular. You sit there, you open your house. It's an open door, you know, could be 3 days, could be 5 days, could be 7 days. And everyone, you know, just comes and they bring food and drink and you just talk and you have community.
You talk about your deceased loved one and tell stories about them?
Yes, on and on. Talk about the deceased loved one, stories, friends, you know, for present, past, family members. It's really beautiful and it's so missed right now. Like my friend, the week after my dad died, my friend's mother just died and the same thing. She's Jewish and they were able to Zoom the funeral and she Zoomed a memorial service and Zoomed, they Zoomed a Shiva, which I'm like, wow, I didn't even know that because I don't even know this world of death and Zoom and COVID. But I do have to say we're lucky because we were allowed, you know, people who have relatives that are dying of COVID can't even go in the hospital, you know, we had to decide, like, if my father stayed in intensive care, only one person could have visited him a day in intensive care. And it kind of like pushed up our decision of him going into hospice. And then hospice, they only allowed two people a day, but at least we were there, you know, we kept sneaking in. The whole family, like all the grandchildren flew in and we kept getting kicked out of the hospital. But, you know, I feel so horrible for these people who also, like we're talking about community, and can't see their poor relative, can't be there with them.
It's a whole other trauma of a whole other level that I'm starting to see in clinical practice now. You know, a whole other layer to the grief is the regret, and the trauma of not being able to be with them as they died, you know. Jill, you said that the making of the documentary made you learn a lot about grief. What did you learn?
God, that's a great question. I learned that it's always on the surface. It will never leave you, but you will smile again. You will find joy by watching Sousa. This is what I learned from Sousa. You will find meaning in your life again. That doesn't mean it's not raw. It doesn't mean that it ever goes away, but you can, and if you hug it like Sousa does, she was brought to a new level of like who she was as a person, a new level in her art, a new level of giving to herself, to family members who lost loved ones, and to everyone who sees this sculpture garden. And now to me, like I made the documentary and now we're opening that up to a new level of whoever watches the film. So I guess I learned as a mother, you could survive the loss of a child. It's weird because it's always been my worst fear. It's always, you know, knock wood, and I'm sure it's every mother's worst fear. And I think in Sousa letting us and Aphrodite and Eileen, like giving us that intimacy of what they went through, it just helps you recognize what they're going through. It helps you, if God forbid you're ever going through it, it helped me. If anyone I know ever has to go through that kind of grief, it's helping me with my mother. It's like that honesty. It's honesty. It's
a gift to humanity. And I think for many people who do experience that deep loss and that deep grief, it's almost compelling. You know, it's mm-hmm. like you're watching out for those coming up behind you and going, I don't know who it was said it. Oh, maybe Niamh Fitzpatrick. You know, shit will happen, but maybe if I tell you where the banana skins are, you can avoid some of them. And it's kind of like that. It's looking out for those who are coming behind you, who are going to experience profound loss, because it will always exist, and doing something to offer a normalization, a validation, even a balm for those who are coming behind.
I mean, that's why I made the film. Like, and I didn't know that's why I was making the film. As I was making the film, I was just so compelled. But really, it was like, these types of senseless atrocities are never going to stop, unfortunately. But, you know, if I think this story will help somebody who's experiencing this, because it's also like, it's such a violent ending to somebody's life and for a relative to deal with. And I'm just hoping that just by watching the story, watching Sousa, watching the other mothers, that anyone who's dealing with that, it'll give them some sort of solace. Like you said, she's paving the way.
Yeah, and I look forward to talking to Sousa. I know she's not available until March or so.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we'll be chatting in March, but I want to ask her, you know, what place did the whole terror aspect of it take for her, or the fact that her son, you know, was one of 270 people who died that day? You know, what were the themes that emerged for her in that? And for those who are listening, it was Pan Am Flight 103, and 270 people died that day. There were 243 passengers, 16 crew members, and 11 people on the ground when that plane was blown up. All lost their lives that day. So we're talking about thousands of people whose lives were irrevocably changed when all of those people died over Lockerbie in Scotland 32 years ago. Is that right?
32 years ago, because it was 1988. So, God, that's a great question. I can't wait for Sousa to talk to you. I mean, that's another thing with the film. I mean, she's looking forward to talking to you. But it's not like a normal film where, like, you know, like when I did the film with Kenny Anderson, it was like, he would do press all the time and talk to anyone. And, you know, but, you know, this is just very different. This is a mother who lost her child. Like, I'm very respectful of that. Like, I'm very respectful of, you know, when she's available and wants to talk and when she says, you know, when she can't. So, but she's looking forward to it. She told me so.
Well, give her my love and my well wishes for the next couple of months, and we will meet. And I know it will be a rich and meaningful conversation when I meet her. But well done to you, Jill, for producing such a beautiful piece of work. And I love the idea that whatever happens or doesn't happen, Dark Elegy, that it is forever held. The stories, the love, the grief is forever held in your work for the world.
Thank you. That means the world to me, really. Thank you so much. It's such a dear project to me. And thank you for speaking to me about it. Thank you for your words. They're really comforting. And I just appreciate it all. So
great to meet you, Jill. And I'll link to the doc. I have shared it already in social media. I'll share it again. And I'll link it to the description of this podcast. So for anybody listening, shapesofgrief.com, look up Jill Campbell. I think you'll be episode 60 something. And I'll have a description there.
Oh, I can't wait. I'll go follow you and connect on social media too.
And I wish you well as you navigate your own grief after your father's death, Jill. And as you accompany your mother and her tremendous grief as well.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck. Yeah.
You. I'm going to actually point her to your podcasts. That will be helpful. So,
well, people report it's so validating just to hear somebody else say, I felt like I was going crazy. How could I ever survive this? And I did survive this. Mm-hmm. We need to share stories, real stories, you know.
These are what make us human. So I agree. We could talk forever.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care. She has come down to condemn.
and their eyes are bound round with ship's sail. She has come down to condemn the wide ocean for the murderous loss of her man. His boat sailed out last Wednesday morning, and it's feared she's gone down with all hands.
Absolutely gorgeous.